You're listening to a Dwell Community Church production. If you'd like to check out more resources, visit dwellcc.org.
It is good to be here and to share with you. I'm going to talk tonight about some ongoing realities. And this is, tomorrow morning, I know we have different CTs. Tomorrow morning, I'll be, walking through a text. But tonight, I'm going to talk about some of the missiological realities. I'm a missiologist. That means my PhD is in the field of missions. And understanding our cultural moment is what I try to help Christians to do. And boy, is our cultural moment complicated today. And you feel it, you know it. And that's what I want to talk about today. And I'm calling this a post-COVID missiology, and post-COVID's in air quotes because, I was, remember July 7th through 11th last year, how awesome it was to be a post-COVID? That was such a great 4 days. I miss those. So I put air quotes around it, but I want to talk some about the realities that we're facing and some of the things that you've seen in the division in culture, you're experiencing in church, and how might we live faithfully and fruitfully on mission in these really complicated times. Because, this has been a time of shaking, right? We know that we're seeing a shaking, and what remains, what we see the Lord doing, where we trust Him in the midst, He's shaken our country, He's shaken the globe, but He's shaken churches, and you've probably experienced some of that shaking in your own house church, in your broader congregation, your CT, your broader congregation as well. So my job as a missiologist is to help us sort of name and understand what's going on in culture, because sometimes by naming and understanding it, we can be more effective of navigating it and walking through the complex times that we're in. So to do that, I'm actually going to talk about, first, the broad reality is it's not just one pandemic. One of the things that we need to recognize is if the pandemic's ending, and it really depends on where you are. I'm in Illinois. We have an indoor mask mandate. It's not without controversy. There was a court case just yesterday with the governor of the mask mandate in schools. We have a mask mandate in schools. But if you go to Texas, they kind of sat out the pandemic. They didn't participate. They've actually been kissing each other on the mouth for 2 years. And so I came here, and I was in Ohio. I went to a gas station where it appears that you guys don't have any plows because it's all still snow. But nobody wearing a mask. I come here, it's in Columbus. So, it's just different everywhere. But the reality is what we're experiencing is it's not just a pandemic of disease, though it is, number one. There's a pandemic of distrust in culture like we've never seen in our lifetime. Not that we've never seen before. People say it's the most divided the country's ever been. They don't have history books if they think that. We had actually a civil war. It was pretty divided during that time. But there's distrust in culture like we haven't seen in my lifetime and in yours, probably since the 60s. We'll talk some about that. But now you just, everything is on social media. People just going at one another. No one is safe from what could be just someone tweeting or Facebooking or whatever it may be. There's a real disorientation of people's identity right now. And some we're going to talk about a little later on about who we are racially and ethnically, about who we are gender. This is all a conversation that is accelerated in significant ways. There's a disruption of mental health. We're experiencing a crisis in mental health really around the world, particularly we're more aware in the U.S. because we have research and studies, but a huge crisis of mental health. You've dealt with it. And yes, division in churches. And we'll talk about that some as well. So it's a real challenging time to walk through. And yet here we are. The moment we're in does not pause the mission we're on. God has called us to this time, and may we be faithful in the midst of it. So if that's the case, what does that look like? Well, I'm going to talk about three things that I want you to see tonight, and we'll go through them one at a time. Now, I want to prepare you ahead of time that in the next 15 minutes, I'm going to talk about vaccines and masks, Donald Trump and Joe Biden, George Floyd, Stop the Steal, the January 6th riot, and I'm going to, so just buckle up, because I need you to do what Taylor Swift says to do. I need you to calm down. Because I want to talk about these things as a cultural observer and what they mean for us. Because the reality is all of those have probably become issues in house groups and churches in ways that 3 years ago would have been inconceivable for you. And yet here we are today. So let's talk a little bit about what's going on in our culture. If we can put some description of it, might help us to understand it more fully. This is an article written by David Brooks. It's not the article that was in the New York Times yesterday, but David Brooks wrote an article in The Atlantic. And David is a relatively new follower of Jesus. He attends an Anglican church, an ACNA church, I believe, in the Washington, D.C. area. had him in class recently. I'm a dean and a professor there at Wheaton, and had him in class with some of my students, and we discussed this article. And the article title is America's Having a Moral Convulsion. Let's look at the subtitle. Levels of trust in this country, in our institutions, in our politics, and in one another are in precipitous decline. No one would disagree with that. And when social trust collapses, nations fall. Can we get it back before it's too late? Now, in the article, David makes an argument that I found very persuasive. And he pointed to a book that explained this, and a couple of books, I think. And in the conversation, or in the article, he explained that every 60 years, in his article, America seems to have a moral convulsion. We saw it in the 60s. We saw it in the late 1800s. Saw it back in the mid-1800s. It seems that we look to one another. We decide the sources of our facts. We decide who we trust, and we sort of change them. They get topsy-turvy. They get all turned around, and it appears. Now, so again, this is not a pandemic-related thing. I think it's a pandemic-accelerated thing. We'll talk about that in just a moment. But America having a moral convulsion. So let's just walk through 2020 and 2021. Beginning of 2020 was the first impeachment, right? So first impeachment there. But soon thereafter, we actually got word of a virus. I think people originally called the Wuhan, either virus or flu. I forget what term they used at the beginning. And people didn't know what to expect, but we just came out. We already knew the country was remarkably divided. People were already divided then about the impeachment. And then the pandemic came. And at first, everyone was, you know, pretty united. Remember, President Trump shut down the country for 2 weeks, right? So it was 2 weeks to stop the spread. Don't you miss 2 weeks to stop the spread? Been a little longer. So everything shut down. And, you know, and very quickly, you know, we worked together and launched coronavirusinthechurch.com. With Saddleback Church, and we partnered together to provide resources for churches. And people were like, what do we do? What do we go online? All these things. 96% of churches in the country paused meeting. So most that didn't were smaller churches in rural areas. So the vast majority of churches paused meeting. Later, that would become controversial. How long? You know, when did they come back? Things of that sort. But we're now into the first part of 2020. And so it wasn't as divided then over the pandemic response. I said, Donna's my wife. We were, after 2 weeks, you know, the 2 week shutdown, the president announced they're going to go another month. And I said to Donna, I'm an extrovert and she's an introvert. And I said to her, so like another month of us just being by ourselves. So as an introvert, is this like really exciting for you? And she smiled and she said, are you going to be here the entire time? So you know, it depends on, you know, how you were dealing with that in that season. You probably remember some of that. I have three daughters, and it was a challenging time. And honestly, I wasn't paying as much attention to them as I should have been because we were working 14 hours a day trying to serve churches. But my oldest one was a college student. All of a sudden, there's no more. All of her friends, you know, she was going to Wheaton College. I live in Wheaton, but all of her friends left. She didn't know anybody else, and she's got at her apartment, and then my middle daughter, everything's canceled at high school, eventually her graduation all canceled, and you know, so it becomes a hard time. It doesn't get divided as quickly then. I wrote an article in USA Today just around that time, and I said, this is going to be the time when evangelical Christians step up, stand out, and stand in the gap, and show and share the love of Jesus. I had a really clever title because it wasn't controversial back then, but I was trying to say, you're going to really see who we are as Christians. You're going to see us evangelicals. We're going to be there for you. And the title of the article was The Masks Are About to Come Down, which ironically became a title that was a little controversial later. oops. So I also wrote a book called Viral Churches 10 years ago. So you never know what your past title. So in hindsight, not the best title. So 2020. So then, right, so no pandemic. And then we saw on the television screen the murder of George Floyd. And people started to decide how to respond. And I don't know what your CTs did. I don't know what your house church did. But kind of all over, people made a decision about how the churches should respond. And most churches, particularly the churches on the large side, did some sort of conversation on racial reconciliation or something like that. A lot of churches mentioned George Floyd by name. People were holding up signs at protests saying, say his name. So I'm starting to make you a little uncomfortable because I don't know what your church did. I didn't ask beforehand. But what your church did or did not do around that time began to be noticed by people in a way that things before were not. So if your church mentioned George Floyd by name, later on people would say, well, okay, did you mention the riots, the summer riots, right? We saw protests. New York Times actually said it was the largest, larger protest in the civil rights movement in the 60s. We saw protests. We saw most of the books that were written on race, let's just say in the evangelical space. Wheaton's an evangelical institution. So in the evangelical space, most of the books written by evangelical authors on race just all sold out. Some went to the New York Times bestseller list. People were asking, how do we know more? How do we understand more about some of the issues? And there was a growing awareness among a lot of white evangelicals in particular saying, well, maybe we need to be more aware about issues of racial injustice. So, but then people were kind of keeping track. What did you say about that? And because then we saw the protests, and whether some people participated, some people didn't participate, some of them people, but you began to feel a tension by the time you got to the summer. Because by the time you got to the summer, you actually, there were riots. I mean, I'm in Chicago. I was the interim pastor at Moody Church. If you know Moody Church, it's in downtown Chicago, kind of an historic, it actually has a TripAdvisor rating, which is strange to me. But people, it's kind of a landmark, famous church, and yet you, if you watch on the news, helicopters and people were, there's phalanxes of police and people in our church, they lost businesses and homes, and we're in the city of Chicago. And so then the question is, people began to ask, well, did you mention that? Or did you just mention George Floyd? And then if you didn't mention that, but then the election comes, right? And so the election comes, we're still in 2020, but the election comes and eventually Fox News calls the election. I use that the network on purpose. Fox News calls the election. And so you got to figure out, what are you going to say on Sunday? As a pastor and a church leader or in your house church, do you pray? Most pastors historically pray for the president-elect. And so you pray for the president. So my phone sort of lights up. People are texting me, what do you think we should do? And so I've known Rick Warren for a very long time. Back in, we used to talk on this thing called CompuServe. So just to date some of us who know what CompuServe is. And so I called him and said, can I do a podcast with you? What are you going to say? And he said, well, we're going to pray for President-elect Biden. Well, all of a sudden, wait a second. So if you mentioned George Floyd by name, maybe you didn't mention summer riots, then you prayed for President-elect Biden, then, well, what about Stop the Steal? And are you legitimizing what, you know, the majority of Republicans actually think the election was illegitimately decided? If you pray for that, you're legitimizing that. And then we're not done. Then fast forward to January 6th, and people broke into the House and the Senate, the floor of the House and the Senate, and they prayed in Jesus' name. And it was kind of jarring to a lot of people. So a lot of churches said, well, should we put out a statement? And if you put out a statement about that, but you didn't mention civil rights, and you didn't mention George Floyd, all of a sudden you start to hear a new word, woke. Or maybe along the way you start to hear about CRT. And so the language, so there's a pushback to that. So wait a second, all these churches are talking about George Floyd, but not supporting the police. They're not speaking up about the riots, and then they are supporting the president-elect. And then January 6th, there were actually rings of people doing different things. January 6th is not one thing. So now by this time, I've probably made you a little anxious. And I want you again to listen to Taylor Swift and calm down. Because my point is, there's nothing like the last 2 years in my lifetime or most of your lifetimes. And in ways that have come impacted the church, because, you know, in the 80s and the 90s, people might have been divided about things. It might have been divided about politics, things of that sort. But we sort of, I'm guessing somewhere along the way, people have said over the years, over the decades here at Xenos and then Dwell, is that, you know, we have people of different political persuasions here. You're welcome, whatever your political background, race, ethnicity. We're united around the gospel. And people would say things like that. And all of a sudden, people were really kind of unsure where churches were on, as a matter of fact, probably into your house church. Well, where are we on these issues? So you can feel the tension. And I hope that the tension is communicated to you, because now it's continued. So we're still in a very divided, confusing time. Now, David called it a moral convulsion. I actually pushed back a little. I'm not pushed back. I mean, he's David Brooks. I'm a motivational speaker who lives in a van down by the river. So So, but I wrote an article in, I'm the editor of a magazine called Outreach Magazine. So I wrote my editor's column about what I'm talking about today. And one of the things I said is that it's not America, and we're in the midst of a cultural convulsion that's actually taking place around the world. And it's multifaceted, and it's seeped into churches in ways that we have not experienced in our lifetime. And you can feel that. You can feel that tension, right? So we're going to talk about what that looks like. But that's not all, right? So, and I'm using some articles to frame this. Let me use another article. This is an article by Ross Douthat. He's a New York Times columnist. He's actually a former evangelical, which you'd all be sort of in the evangelical category as part of Dwell and Zenos, who converted to devout Roman Catholicism. And he's a conservative Catholic. He writes critical articles about the current Pope and other things and books. So he wrote this really helpful article. Actually, his name's not on the slide. It's Ross Douthat is his name, Douthat. And this is June 27th, 2020, and I think it was so right on that I want to use it as a springboard for some more discussion. So we're in a cultural convulsion, but everything has accelerated. And his article here is "The Suspended Time of the Pandemic Has Put History on Fast Forward." So let's talk about what that might look like. What he says is that, you know, we would have had 10 years to talk about how we understand race. We would have had 10 years to talk about how we understand gender. All of a sudden, it's like, we woke up in 2030 while it was still 2020. So let's use the example of race. Now, again, everyone's going to have different views and different opinions. You don't have to, I'm going to share some of the conversation, but you don't have to share my opinion. But so for some people, they said, okay, you know, we now have come to a new discovery that everything in this country is actually built on a structure that's racist in its identity and projects that racism into the present. Things like the 1619 Project. Some advocates of critical race theory, but the idea is that everything is built on that, and you peel it back and see the rotten core underneath. So that's a sudden, and that's a newer idea for a whole lot of people. That's a sudden acceleration. Whereas, but don't miss this too. Remember, after George Floyd, a whole lot of people said, "Well, I want to understand more." You remember, people had panels and discussions, and so most people were accelerating at some level, saying, "I want to understand more." Some went all the way here. Some went all the way here. Some went all the way here. Some went, "Hey, wait a second, we don't need to go any of there." Waking up in 2030. Or let's talk about sexuality and gender, right? So same-sex marriage, the law of the land. But the conversation around same-sex marriage went from, depending upon how you count some of these historically, something called Stonewall, which was a bar in New York City that was a riot and a protest, and that's seen as the beginning of this. From Stonewall to Obergefell, which is the Supreme Court case, was 40-something years. So 40 years of debate and conversation and states and all this sort of stuff. Gender identity seems like a 3-4-year-old conversation for most people. That's suddenly accelerated in the last 2 years. To the place now, if you're a Chicago police officer, you sign the union, or the union signed a contract that if you misgender somebody, you can actually lose your job. So things like gender identity and the use of pronouns. My oldest daughter is a student at the University of Toronto. She's just assumed every class you start by giving your pronouns. It's, you know, very, very much the assumption of that. Students at universities around here, that would be probably not every class, but not an uncommon thing to experience. So that sudden acceleration. And so what's probably happened, now again, I have not looked over things, but I'm guessing you have had conversations about race and gender identity in the last 2 or 3 years that you didn't have prior for 10 years. I see the heads nodding. So the sudden acceleration of culture has also caused a lot of people to stand athwart the acceleration and say, stop. And as an evangelical Christian who has, you know, very distinct, and I'm not doing a whole teaching on gender identity, but who believes what the Bible teaches about sex and gender, who does believe that systemic racism is real, but has concerns about where some people take it, that if it's, you know, if it's, you know, puts people into groups that are irreparable and unforgivable, and you know, and so all of a sudden, these are things that I didn't even talk about in seminary. And all of a sudden, these are defining issues of our day today. And churches are wrestling through, and your house church is wrestling through. And here's the challenge. Most of you in house church, I mean, I sat down recently with a guy in Wheaton. He's got a PhD from Cambridge not long ago. He graduated. And maybe 3 or 4 years ago. So we're having lunch outside, and he says, you know, Ed, every major issue in my church, nobody talked about in seminary 3 years ago, in PhD level work 3 years ago. And now all of you are leading house church for people like, and I, you know, I preach, I'm a teaching pastor at my church in Chicago. And I've had more people come up to me in the last 2 years who say something like this. I have a niece who has transitioned to, and wants me to now recognize him or her. I don't know what language they use, but now wants me to change pronouns. That's my nephew, use the pronoun he to describe. What do I do? No one asked me that question 5 years ago. Now I've been asked that question pretty regularly. And we see it in numbers in elementary school, middle school and high school, maybe elementary school. So the shift in our culture is substantive and disruptive. And all of these things are things that have taken inside the church in a way that has not happened in our lifetime. Now, it has happened before. The 1960s, it went into your church. Because your church had to take, I don't think Xenos existed in 1960s, I don't think. But in the 1960s, your church needed to take a stand on where it was on the civil rights movement. There was a prominent pastor by the name of Martin Luther King Jr. who was calling pastors to speak up, calling out those who did not, called them the white moderates. And you had to take a stand and a position on these things. Just recently, now with the Lord pastor, very famous pastor, all of you would probably know his name, a letter that he wrote in 1968 was all over the internet. He changed his views, but in 1968, he wrote a letter to Wheaton College. And I don't know how it got on the internet. I don't know that we released it, but in that letter, he said, I see the students at Wheaton College have memorialized the death of, I don't know who he said, Martin Luther King Jr., but it was, you know, written just right after his assassination. And it says, and I will never send another student to that school if you celebrate that Marxist. Now, by the way, Martin Luther King Jr. was not a popular person on his death. Wasn't popular in America, wasn't even supported all across the African American community, now tends to be universally appreciated, or at least near universally appreciated. So 1968, you kind of had to say, where are we on the civil rights movement in a way that you didn't have to before? Or the Vietnam War in a way you didn't have to before? We haven't had that in our lifetime. So all of a sudden, the churches and Christian leaders are having to make comments or stepping into controversies that they didn't know. I don't know anything about your church. I'm willing to bet that somebody said something that they had to subsequently come back and correct after they said it in the last 2 years. Just to clarify what I meant last time. Because people are keeping track in ways that they haven't before. So we see the cultural convulsion and the sudden acceleration simultaneously going on. But that's not all. So let's talk some about COVID and the great sort. Again, this is my language. I use the cultural convulsion language rather than the moral convulsion language in my magazine and my speaking. So the great sort is also relatively new. So what's happening is I'm willing to bet. Are we against betting here? No, okay, I don't really know the rules. But I'm willing to guess that some people have left your church in the last 2 years because you weren't engaged enough on some issues or because you were engaged on the issues in the wrong way. So what's happening right now is people are sorting themselves out in ways we haven't seen again in our lifetime. Because 10 years ago, we all would have said, we got Republicans and Democrats and independents, and we got the commonality of the gospel, and we're all in this together. That's not a phrase that's as easy to say in 2022. So people are, now why would people sort themselves this way? Well, here's one of the things that we found. Discipleship, I mean, you already know your church is a unique expression of the body of Christ. Well, one of the things we found is our discipleship was not as robust as we thought. People were very quickly and obviously being discipled more by their cable news choices than by their local church. They're being spiritually shaped by their social media more than their house church. And so that was a disturbing thing. Now, you have a very robust disciple-making process, but I know it's probably buffeted you as well. And it shouldn't surprise us. I mean, people watch their cable news for 20 hours a week. and whether it's, you know, CNN or MSNBC or Fox News, but keep in mind too that for a whole lot of people, there are things to the left and right of those options now as well. And so you begin to hear 20 hours a week certain things. You say, well, my church isn't reflecting that. Why is my church talking about race when clearly that's this or that's that? So all of a sudden people begin to sort themselves out. So for the people have done this before, but for a way not seen in my lifetime, people are sorting themselves ideologically. Now, I was talking to a pastor friend of mine. He's a student of ours. He's a pastor in Texas, in Dallas there. His name's Matt Chandler. He's a student in our program. Matt says, I can take you around churches in Dallas-Fort Worth, and I can show you that's a Fox News church, that's a CNN church, that's an MSNBC church. He'll actually say, Fox News broadcasts from that church. Now, I don't know what he is. Or maybe he's the MSNBC church, for that matter. I don't know. But here's what we know. People have sorted themselves probably out of your church into churches that are more ideologically aligned and less theologically aligned in the past few years in a way they haven't in the prior decade. So what does that mean? And we ought to be not so naive to think that doesn't impact us. You know, there are certain things we want to hear our church talk about. We want to hear our church care about. So the great sort is really needs to speak to some of the challenges, including the challenge of social media. Technology is an interesting thing. Let me show you this piece of technology. This changed the ancient world. The Roman Empire, 2,000 years ago. Rome was the first city in the West to be 1 million people. And when Rome fell and shrunk to as lower than 50,000 people, but when Rome fell, there wasn't another city in the world of 1 million people, a city in the Western world, 1 million people, people debate others, to London in the 1700s. So 1 million people is really unheard of. You know, people, a town of 5,000 was a big town. So Rome, 1 million people, and they discovered a metal that was particularly malleable, moldable, malleable is the technical term. And they built pipes out of it. Well, you know, they already had these Roman roads, they always had these amazing aqueducts, but the rich in Rome 2,000 years ago had hot and cold running water in their villas. Slaves would heat the water and bring it in through these pipes that they made. You can see it's actually folded over. It's not welded, it's bent because they didn't have tools to weld, but this malleable metal. So it was so amazing that they have hot and cold running water. It was so amazing they made cups out of it, they made plates out of it. I mean, the rich would drink and dine from this, and it was this metal was technologically amazing, feeding them, but it was also called lead. If you look at the end of that stamp, Fermia. So this lead, I mean, it's not a mainstream view, but some historians actually think it's part of the madness that led to the fall of Rome. But the technology, amazing technology, was feeding them and killing them at the same time. I think this does the same. This morning on my radio show, I talked to Chris Martin. He's got a new book called Terms of Service. He's about social media and the Christian. And, you know, when this got on our phones, it changed everything. I wasn't really, I mentioned CompuServe. How many of you were with me on CompuServe in the 90s? Thank you. Thank you. These young whippersnappers with their Instas. We had CompuServe. Cost $1 to send an email back then. You could go inside the forum, but $1 to send an email outside. So, but it got on our phones. You know, again, I'm the father of three daughters, and one was raised before social media was on the phone, one was raised as social media was on the phone, going on the phone, and one was raised after. And they talk amongst themselves about the differences they have with engaging social media. So it's a big shift, right? It's a big shift, and you can see it all day long on your phone and engage. And what I would say is it's having some significant impact on our culture and its division and more. And so we see, I mean, it's social media is in the news every day now. You know, Facebook's revelation that their algorithm chose and directed people to more divisive things, and they chose profit over community, and you know, all these things. And I will tell you, social media has overpowered a lot of the discipleship in our local churches and showed some of the shallowness, which again, I'm so thankful for how you have pressed in more deeply on some of these issues. So we can see part of the challenge is the sort, right? The COVID and the great sort. So I talk about COVID and our cultural convulsion, COVID and the great sort. And then I want to talk about COVID and layers of disengagement. Again, I have not looked at the numbers of your church, but all across the country, people are asking, what percentage of people have returned? Now, it's different in different places. Until last Sunday, I was the interim pastor of a church in New York City. It's called Calvary, and it's right across the street from Carnegie Hall, and it's an old historic church, 175 years old. And we're back, but like at 25, 30, 40%. New York City was hit hard and early, and a lot of people just moved away. And so now I'm in Chicago, we're at 60% back for a lot of the churches in the western suburb of Chicago. Before I was at Calvary, I was at Moody, and Moody actually didn't meet in person for a year, partly because of Chicago's rules. Chicago, the mayor of Chicago said, anywhere in groups of 50, we're going to break them up, we're going to send the cops in. And Moody, you know, went through, prayed through, and made the decision, their elders made the decision how best to respond. But actually, I finished up the interim there last year, about 18 months ago, and they did a nice little, because it was closed down when I finished, they did a nice little going away for me in August when they had started back up. And so I got there, and if you've been to Moody, any of you been to the Moody Church building, just out of interest, some of you, yeah, it's kind of, like I said, it's kind of an historic landmark. 3,750 seats, all Warren Wiersbe used to say, come in, grab a seat, any seat, they're all equally uncomfortable, and they are. But I got up and said, hey, thank you so much for letting me your interim. This is what the church looked like when I started as your interim. And I put a picture up at Easter service of full and said, this is what it looks like when I finished it and it was empty because COVID shut the whole place down. So, but at Easter 2021, they gathered back together. But they're in an urban setting. Urban settings tend to be lower engagement. Actually, African-American churches have gathered at a lower rate than Anglo churches as well. So we see... So I don't know what percent you're back, but here's what we see, what we've seen. When you take the average across the country, because in the South, it's higher. People have gathered back at a higher level. Columbus, Cincinnati, they're kind of like in this, there's a mix between the two. You know that. But this is not Cincinnati. I know. Mark Twain said of Cincinnati that when the end of the world comes, he wants to be in Cincinnati because it's 20 years behind everywhere else. I'm not saying that's true. I'm just saying what Mark Twain, Samuel Clemens wrote. So what seems to have happened is different percentages, you know, North is different, urban is different. People of color tend to be gathering at a lower level. So what seems to have happened is that giving in most churches did not actually collapse the way it looked like in the beginning of the pandemic. Now, again, you had a big financial meeting last night, so I have no idea what your giving was, because as exciting as it was, I wasn't coming to your financial meeting. So now you got a thumbs up. So why then did giving, if attendance is probably down, I don't know if it is here, but it's probably down at Dwell. If that's the case, why is it that the majority of churches are either at or above their 2019 giving? So something happened. It appears that a significant number of people in the pandemic actually got more involved in church, gave more, served more, and probably you have people in mind. They say, you know, they weren't as involved before the pandemic, but they stepped up, stood out, stood in the gap. Our church mobilized and was motivated, and we had a certain percent of our people get engaged more. And that's been a great thing. That's what I wrote about at the beginning of 2020. That's what I was hoping for. And I think it happened. My church, you know, we have, you know, a little coffee shop, just like you have a coffee shop. It's, you know, it's not a church in today's world if you know a coffee shop. You know, we closed ours down, turned it into a food pantry. We have a lot of refugees who live right around there. It happens to be a key refugee resettlement area, DuPage County, where I live. So we were all engaged in that. So what we found is some of our church got more involved. But if you remember back in March, April, May of 2020, it was a financial collapse in a lot of churches. People didn't know what was going to happen. Seems to have turned around. By the time you got to the summer 2020 in some ways. So what's going on? Well, let's talk a little bit about how, I use an example about how churches sit. This is going to be a little strange because it really depends on the culture of the church. But Pentecostals tend to sit the most involved people up front. How many of you got a little Pentecostal charismatic in you? Just raise both hands. There you go. I see those hands. I see them. All right, I'm with you. So let's say you're a Pentecostal church of 100 people. Okay, now you guys didn't do this. You know, you're the only one sitting. There's like three rows all around you. There you go, brother. Bring it on. in a Pentecostal church, all the most involved people will be sitting up front. And then the front third of a Pentecostal church tends to be the most involved people. So I want to just use it. Let's all think of ourselves as a Pentecostal church of 100. The front third got more involved, more engaged, and more. And I think that's a great thing. It's one of the reasons why those direst thoughts in spring 2020 and early summer 2020 did not come into being. People stepped up, stood out, gave more, served more. And I bet you were celebrating. I'm guessing you probably celebrated some of that last night. So second third of the church, if we're back to here, right, front third, the second third of the church, and again, it might be different than yours. I'm talking about an average across America. So don't think, well, our church is more or less, could be. The second third of most churches seems to have been just hanging on. Maybe they buffeted some by the great sort. They're trying to figure out who they are, where they're going. They're still in. They haven't left. They weren't the biggest givers to start with. You know, the front third were the people who probably supported most of the life of the church. They were the tithers, the givers, whatever, you know, construct you use for that. The back third, though, let's talk about the back third for just a moment. Because in a church of 100, the back third should be 33 people, but it's really not. Because again, go over here, the front third got more engaged and more involved. Second third kind of hanging on, not ready. You haven't left, but are still here, kind of buffeted. The back third on a given Sunday is 33 people. But the back third are people who show up Christmas, Easter, and three or four times other a year. And there probably were, now because of the high level commitment that you guys kind of call for in your church, my guess is the back third of your church is not as big as some kind, but it could be. Again, I don't know all the details of your church. But the back third of the church is people who sort of rotate in and out. They're irregular. They're loosely connected. So here's what we see, though. All across the country, the back third of the church seems to have mostly, if not completely, disengaged in the life of the church. And this, in a church of 100, could be 75, 100, 125, 150 people. So what we've seen is, as churches have regathered back, their infrequent and low engagement attenders have moved to hardly ever attending and disconnecting. And for most of us, that's a lot of where our evangelism takes place. And it's strange to people because, you know, we know they're coming to church. They might come to church six times a year. But we do sort of think our role is to help them move to maybe not understanding the gospel, to rightly understanding the gospel, Jesus' death on the cross for our sin in our place. It's not about being a good person. It's not about coming to church on Sunday. It's about knowing, being born again, being changed by the power of the gospel. So the challenge is, and so let's just take a look. So what we found is that during the pandemic and in the last 2 years, because it's not just a pandemic, is that a third of the people seem to be more committed, a third hanging on waiting, and a third disconnected potentially permanently. Now, I'm convinced that one of the things we've got to do, and again, I wouldn't be surprised if the numbers are different because of the high level commitment you call for in your church context, but my guess is that though the percentages might be different, the reality remains the same. So what are we to do? Well, I think the opportunity before us is actually to take that front third and help the second third be engaged like the front third. Call them, challenge them, walk alongside of them. So the second third becomes more like the first third, and then we can together go re-engage the back third and the world beyond. Because I don't know what's going to happen with the pandemic, but it appears that increasingly people, and I'm not a doctor. Well, I am a doctor, but the my kids tell me I'm the kind of doctor that doesn't help anybody. But if we're about to move to the stage of the current situation in the world where we're no longer talking about a pandemic, we move to endemic, this Easter could be an opportune moment for us to re-engage, for that front third to partner with the second third, help them get engaged and involved at a higher level, and go out and reach that third third, because it's been 2 years since a lot of them have had any connection to the life of a local church. Because if you're sort of in a low commitment place in your life related to church, you're kind of just, it's an easy reason not to go to church. You know, I see, when I came in here, like I said, I went to the gas station and nobody wearing a mask. I came in here, we're all wearing masks. There are a lot of people just saying, oh, I got to wear a mask, I'm not going to go to church. There's a lot of people said, if I got to be around people, I'm not going to go to church. And so you find for the first time, some of that is giving people reason to back away and to step away. Now, some of that too is the cultural division around us. Because depending how long Dwell did not meet, some people thought you were compromised cowards. Some people thought when you started to meet, you're horrible. We're in the middle of a pandemic. Some people thought, well, you're eating with masks. We shouldn't meet with masks. Well, I know, but it's Columbus says we have to. But still, people in our churches all over the country are defying those things. Why are we not? Why are we compromised cowards? And then other people saying, why are you callously disregarding the health of other people by meeting in a pandemic? And I will tell you that as pastors, this has been probably the hardest time to lead for most pastors in our lifetime. And as house church leaders, you're functioning in that role that you're dealing with some of the same thing that pastors are as well. So what does it mean for us moving forward? Well, first, I don't think it ends by Easter. I told you hopefully we're talking differently about the pandemic by then. I think we're all feeling we're a very different place. I got COVID. I got Delta. I got last season style. What's up with that? I got Delta over Christmas. So Merry Christmas. I'm finishing up. Did you see the national news when they closed down Broadway and the Rockettes show closed down? I was in the line for the Rockettes show when they came out and said, we've had an outbreak. We're shutting down. The cameras were everywhere, and I got it there. I mean, I don't know if I got it at the Rockettes. I wasn't hanging around with the Rockettes. So I came back, Merry Christmas. You know, I'm locked up with Delta. But, you know, all of us kind of have the story, and some of us have strong feelings. Matter of fact, me saying, even when I said mass, I'm like, well, I got an opinion. I know, we all have an opinion. And churches and house churches have had to navigate opinions like we've never had before. And motives and values and accusations have all been present and evident. But here's the thing I want you to hear. So if we're coming to the end of the pandemic phase and moving into the endemic phase. Did I hear someone cheer over there? I'd be for that. We're pretty tired of it at my house. The problem is this, and this is the part that I want to say to you, is the bad news. I mean, that could be the good news, right? The bad news is cultural convulsions don't generally last 2 years. So the cultural division that we're feeling now is probably not going away. 4 to 6 years is what I think Brooks talks about, 4 to 6 years. So we could be in for 2 to 4 more years. Most of you are not old enough to remember the 60s. But it felt that way. It was more divided in the 60s than it is today. It was more tumultuous in the 60s than it is today. And here, so what does that mean? I think that means for us, we're going to have to build reservoirs of resilience as leaders, as house church leaders, as pastors, as staff, as central teaching, all these things. We're going to have to build reservoirs of resilience. And we're going to have to call people to a radical life of discipleship that is not driven by the cultural forces of our day to the right and to the left, but is driven by a scriptural understanding of what it means to be a disciple and to live on mission in a very difficult time. Now, that's not so easy, to be perfectly honest. 1968 might be the peak of some of the difficult times. And I'm going to talk just a few minutes and take your questions. I'm sure it's going to be exciting. And I don't mind that at all. Ask anything you want. But I want to take you back to 1968. Does anybody have a living memory of 1968 in the room? Okay, some of you have a living memory of 1968. You're like right there. You can remember. You're like, you can remember that. Remember that. Okay. How old were you in 1968?
I was in college at Kent State.
Oh, ho, ho, ho. Wow. I'm done. A lot more divided at Kent State in the 1968. Some of you don't. 1968 is where the National Guard opened fire on some students, and so okay, just not all. Some of you are like too young to remember Kent State. So I'm too young to remember Kent State. I read it in a history book. But the whole country was coming apart at the seams. Civil rights protests, right? Millions of people. Vietnam War protests. That was a Vietnam War protest. So, and they weren't always the same. Sometimes they overlapped, but they were different. Martin Luther King assassinated April 4. Bobby Kennedy assassinated that year. Here, you know, a lot of people forget. There was a pandemic that year. Do you remember? Hong Kong flu. Now we call it H3N2. But it was a pandemic that year. Now, they reacted very differently to a pandemic in 1968. They started planning Woodstock. We shut everything down. They started planning Woodstock. 1969 was Woodstock. But 1968, if you're a college kid at Kent State in 1968, all you see is the world on fire. Yet the Lord was doing something too. There was a pastor in California who said to his daughter, "I want to meet a hippie." Which is so funny that a pastor would articulate that. "I'd like to meet a hippie." He was a kind of a square, to use the language of the day, Pentecostal pastor in the Four Square denomination. Went to Life Pacific Bible College, said, "I want to meet a hippie." So she brought home a hippie. And they met, and he was a new believer, had a life that had a lot of challenges to walk through. And that hippie and that pastor said, "Well, let's," they started a Bible study together. And soon 1,000 people were coming to the Bible study. That hippie's name was Lonnie Frisbee. You can Google his name. It's actually a documentary made about him. That pastor's name was Chuck Smith. And so they started this Bible study. Some of you know the name Chuck Smith. He would found Calvary Chapel. Well, he didn't found Calvary Chapel. He was he transitioned to the church and renamed it to Calvary Chapel. And 1,000 people come, and then thousands of people come, and soon they started these things up and down the West Coast, like they're communes and coffee houses, and we don't do communes much anymore. Do you miss those from the 60s? I sense that. If you went to Kent State, I bet you know a commune. But here's the thing. It explodes, and we call that today the Jesus People Movement. It started in the midst of the last cultural convulsion. Now, it wasn't perfect, but 20 to 30 million people, depending on which historian you listen to, trace their spiritual heritage in some way to the Jesus People Movement. I just wonder how many of you in this room would trace your spiritual heritage to the Jesus People Movement. Anybody? Whole bunch of hands. That happened in the midst of a cultural convulsion. Now, since the room's a little older, with a 30-plus, let me tell you what we did this fall. Last fall 2020, we were going to do a 50th reunion, seeing 1970 as the peak of the Jesus People Movement, of the Jesus People Movement in Southern California. So I got together, some of you will appreciate this, some of you have no earthly idea who I'm talking about. I got together second chapter of Acts. Come on, come on, come on. Brian, you don't even know who these people are, do you? Just a young whippersnapper. Got together second chapter of Acts, got Nancy Honeytree to come, Melody Green, Keith Green's widow, Salt Company, Love Song, Chuck Gerard, and we had a big, we were going to do it in fall 2020, but we figured bringing a bunch of 75-year-olds to Southern California last fall was not a good idea. So we delayed a year, and we did it this year. And it was super, I had Greg Laurie speak, some others as well, I mentioned Matt Chandler spoke, I spoke, several others did. And it was fascinating to hear them because they got up and we had all the Biola, it was at Biola University, so we had all the Biola students come. And they get, and these are all like really super charismatic-y, Pentecostal-y people, so it's not, I mean, it's super Pentecostal-y. Biola's not super Pentecostal-y. So they start getting up, and what's fascinating was they kept talking about late 1960s and they said, "You guys, this is what we went through in the 60s, and God brought a revival." Really, a spiritual outbreak that even people in this room raised their hand. By the way, me too. Later, it was about 10 years later, but me too experienced that spiritual transformation in and around and impacted through the Jesus People Movement. So 1968, I think we're going through that again. Now, here's the thing. The cultural convulsion of the 60s lasted 4 to 6 years. We got to the 70s, and we got disco. So let's hope that doesn't happen again. Right? We got to be opposed to that. So I'm of the view that we are in a great season of shaking in the church. But so were they in 1968. In the late 1800s and other times. And what you'll find is awakenings encounter disturbances. Doesn't mean it's easy. I'll just tell you personally, I was, we were just working. You know, our team, we had actually been the Trump administration of the Health and Human Services this is before COVID, AIDS right now is spreading fastest among rural religious communities. So we came in, had a meeting, and we were meeting with the Surgeon General about this with me and the head of the Church of God in Christ, which is an African-American Pentecostal denomination, head of the National Association of Evangelicals, and we were meeting with the Surgeon General. He came back from a meeting late to our meeting because they just had a meeting about the Wuhan situation. And he came back and he said to us, this is going to be the biggest deal. I forget his exact language, but it's going to be a big deal. We didn't have much of our conversation about the spread of HIV/AIDS in rural religious communities. Instead said, you need to warn the churches. So we kind of did. And so we were working. 14, 15 hour days, my whole team, we mobilized. We had to help churches because we did a whole webinar and seminar on how to speak to a camera. Who was thinking about how to speak to a camera 2 years ago? I did a Facebook Live that a couple hundred thousand people actually watched, and I just talked about, this. What does it look like when we walk through this? And it was a lot going on, but we wanted to serve churches, and a friend of mine, as a pastor friend of mine, he Darren Patrick was his name. You could Google his name because he died from a self-inflicted gunshot wound. And I remember getting the news, and I didn't have anything left. The pandemic had just sapped by that time. We were working 14, 16 hours a day. And that was just the day for me when I said, Lord, I'm just broken in that day. And I actually went to my doctor and I said, I have this anxiety. I've always been an advocate for Christians engaging mental health and because of a family situation, but never really done. I went to the doctor and said, I got to make, and we made some lifestyle changes, very, very helpful. But if you came into 2020 without reservoirs of resilience, you were in trouble quickly. If you came into 2020 with some reservoirs, they got depleted quickly. Here's what I want to say to you, is we're not a couple of months away from the other side of the cultural convulsion. We could be a couple of years or more away from the other side of the cultural convulsion. So what can or should we do? Well, I'm a believer that the Lord has brought us to the roles, the positions we have for such a time as this. And in God's goodness and God's sovereignty, your unique approach to church and life, which I don't, have all the details. I did 10 years ago, I did your summer institute. And they had me back, but after a long time. So, just saying. But if we're at the cusp of a spiritual breakthrough, I do indeed think that the next few months, we're already seeing some inklings and discussions of this around the world. People saying, pastors saying to me, in a way I've never seen before, I see a spiritual hunger. Because the modern experiment has failed. This is not working. And that's what people said in 1968. They said, it's not working. And so what did they find? They found another way. They found one way. They had a little symbol in one way. And it's a more complex time, but the answer is still the gospel. The answer is still God's people walking together on God's mission, sharing the good news of the gospel to a broken and hurting world. It's just the brokenness and hurting has just become so much more evident than we ever expected. So I've got more to say, and I don't want to take I want to take into our Q&A time. But let me just give you the opportunity. I think we've got some microphones, and I understand you are not a shy people. So no questions off limits, and I'm here to answer any of your questions for as long as you want to ask your questions.
I'm wondering how you answered the queries about the gender pronoun. Yeah. How do I address that? And anything you'd like to say about that?
Yeah. So great question, and one that's very, very common. It didn't used to be very common. Very common today. So I do believe that God has made us in His image, male and female. He created us. I do believe that that people are biologically, and thus they are and remain as individuals who are male or female. I recognize there are some intersex things that we can talk through, but a very, very small percentage. Doesn't mean it's not real, but a very, very small percentage. I think gender dysphoria is also real. So people, and this is one of the things I think as a pastoral response, we want to recognize that there are women and men who have gender, and by the way, everybody, so like evangelical Christians, even conservative evangelical Christians like me, We think, everyone thinks gender dysphoria is real, and that's actually the language that people use who would be much more progressive and would say that gender is much more fluid. So everyone could agree gender dysphoria is real. People do not often feel that their gender aligns with their physical sex. And so I think, and Mark Yarhouse, who's at Wheaton College now, he's the world's leading evangelical scholar on gender and sexuality. And he's actually like well-respected in the secular world as well. Yarhouse, Yarhouse. And his new book on gender dysphoria actually is just excellent. And it's based on a lot of experience and a lot of counseling. So for me, what I say to a person is, I recognize that part of what we have is we have I don't know everyone in this room, but I'm assuming most of you have a conviction that should be similar to the one I just articulated. So the question then becomes is if you're in a relationship with somebody in your family, that you have to then make a decision of what do I need to do to maintain the relationship? Because most people, particularly adolescents who go through gender dysphoria, actually resolve the gender dysphoria. And so the question then becomes is, can I be an ongoing influence in my life? And this is where it becomes tricky. People are like, okay, so if I use pronouns and I can stay in relationship, but they already know what I think, so I'm not, is that something I want to do? And that's, I think, individual conscience that people need to decide. Some people say, no, I don't want to participate in a fiction, and that would be language that people would use. I would say that as a pastor and a church leader, and for those of you in house church leaders, I would want to make space for people in your community who are experiencing gender dysphoria, while they probably already understand your view, because they're, you know, it's not a secret what churches, I mean, not all churches, but churches like CNOS Dwell think. So then you just have to figure out how can we make space where we don't feel we're violating our conscience and convictions. But I do think it's a conscience and conviction issue for each person. And I think particularly as a parent, you need to do what is best for the relationship, that you continue to maintain your integrity as a person, what you believe and what you teach, and the relationship with your child. And I think we need to all give grace to people who are walking through this with members of their family and others. But I do think it's an individual conscience issue and how best you respond. That's how I answer that question. But I do say you need to keep in mind the relationship and being able to stay in that relationship. I think that's a key thing. Good. I think there was a question over here. Yes, sir. And tell me your name.
Jim.
Hey, Jim.
A question on how you view, how much do you expose yourself to be engaged with the culture on both sides, especially with social media?
Yeah.
Because I tend to not want to engage with it at all. Mm-hmm. And my wife has challenged me on that because it's like we have to know what's going on. But most of what I see is, personally, I see it as destructive. So I don't know how to regulate that and how to be. So I wonder if you could talk about that.
It's a great question. And what I would say, Jim, right, is a lot of it has to be your own tolerance for it. So, you know, I am somewhat of a public figure. So I want to be aware of what's going on. But social media amplifies the extremes. And so you have to kind of take that into account. So a social media controversy can explode, and it's not a real-world controversy. And people can say, because, you know, anyone can tag, there can be thousands of people, and yet it doesn't make any conversation. Keep in mind, like Twitter. Twitter is, if you look at social media, Twitter's the most toxic now. Facebook a little less so, but not exactly a bastion of health. And Instagram, everyone's happy. They're just posting pictures. They're all fake pictures of happiness that nobody really experiences at that level. And then Pinterest is like nirvana. But anyway, no men are allowed to post on Pinterest, I think. Can I say that? Don't send me letters. So what I would say is if you find, like I sometimes do, that I get caught up too much worrying about the social media du jour, I can and should step away from that. And I think you can self-regulate that. I could say, well, let's say if your wife, first of all, always listen to your wife. And if Jim's wife is saying you should be aware, then make some time to be aware, but don't doom scroll. I mean, you know, doom scrolling. You know, keep in mind, you ever get to the end of the scroll? There is no end to the scroll. There's tens of thousands of people on the other side of that who are trying to make sure you come back. So you have to ask, can I, Jim, can I, Ed, monitor and regulate my own activity so my own soul is not negatively impacted, but I still can be engaged and informed? And I think there's a balance that's there. You know, as a parent, we don't let our daughter have, we have a 17-year-old now, so it's getting a little different. But, you know, even now, she doesn't get to go social media all night. So I think I can do that for myself. I need to do that for myself. And so what I would say is listen to your wife, see how much it's going to take for you to be aware. But I'm not sure social media is the best place to gain awareness. Because social media amplifies things on the extremes. And so that'd be my answer to the question. What a great question, Jim. What a great question. Good. Good. Somebody else. Are you coming up to ask a question? Excellent. Tell me your name.
I'm Leslie.
Hi, Leslie.
Hi. I was wondering if you think we're in one or more convulsions, because I do remember things brewing before 2020.
Exactly.
Politically and stuff like that. And if you think you have a guess as to when the current convulsion or convulsions started.
That's kind of, it's a great question, Leslie, because I'm kind of hoping it started before 2020, because then we don't have to go 10 years through it. So I wrote the book you read. My publisher, Tyndale, comes to me and says, we think you should write a book on outrage. It was 2016. And I said, you know why? I mean, it's 2016. Everyone was outraged. People had very different opinions on the election. I remember 2016. So I said to them, it takes a year to write a book and then a year to go through. It was published in 2018. I said to my publisher in a room, I said, I'm not sure people are still going to be outraged at 2018. It's 2022 and you're studying the book. So what I would say is, if I could talk politics, right? By the time you get to, I mean, it's been divided for a long time, but the George W. Bush administration, you begin to see a level of vitriol that seems, a little higher than even under Clinton and under Carter and under George H.W. Bush. So you could see it ramp up. And most people, you can actually, I have a little slide, I can't pull it up here, that you can actually show the division growing. So when I lived in Pennsylvania, I lived in Erie, Pennsylvania. I planted a church in Erie. Some of you know where Erie is. When I was there, we had a moderate Democrat pro-life governor and a moderate Republican congressman. None of those exist anymore. I mean, maybe rarely. So you can begin to see that. And Bush, and then Obama, then with the Clinton, Hillary Clinton, Donald Trump election. And then it continues. And so it could be a decade old, but it all felt very different to most of us in 2020. And I think the summer of 2020 was the point when everyone looked around and said, this place is on huge fire. This is in division in a way we've never seen before. So I tend to think, the 60s were divided in the early 60s, but by the time you got to 68, Chicago, the mayor of Chicago said, go bust everyone's heads open in Grant Park. You could see Dan Rather pushed at the DNC and it made global news. By the time you got to that was sort of when, okay, this is the world's on fire. It feels to me like that's a newer thing. But there's certainly been division for probably 8, 9, 10 years in ways that we haven't seen in our lifetime. But this is peak. I'm hoping it's peak. Because, I mean, I don't know where we go from here as a nation. I mean, I'm glad I'm not in Ohio. In Illinois, they don't run ads for the president. Because we don't count. Because the election in Illinois is, decided. I was going to make a joke about people vote early and vote often, but that's controversial now to make that joke. But you guys are in Ohio. You're in the heart of Columbus, Ohio, the heart of the most divisive elections that are here. So you must feel it in particular. But probably peaking, hopefully peaking this year, next few years. I think this midterms are going to be really a big divisive time, but it's just all around us in culture. So it's just not sustainable. It's not sustainable. Ryan, I know him. Only person I know.
Just first of all, thank you so much.
Oh, God,
wonderful material. Great. And I think all of us here absolutely resonate with a lot of the scenarios that you're laying out. Whether it's at the home church level or at the entire church level, mm-hmm. it's been a crazy time to figure out. Okay, what do you say? What do you not say? Yep. How do you engage? Silence is a form of a statement, and all those things. But one of the things that concerns me particularly is going back several years, going back to before the 2020 election, we were engaging with our people saying, listen, the gospel is more important than politics, right? Yeah. And it was, we have to get above the noise. We have to, this is an opportunity.
I miss those days when we used to say that, but I agree.
Right, and historically our church was, I would say it was very apolitical.
Right, sure.
And in the environment and the culture that we have right now, that's not possible in the same way because people have much stronger convictions because they've been through the sort.
Sure.
Right. And so if you don't say anything, you're saying something.
Right. Sure. I mean, again, people were holding up signs saying, say his name regarding George Floyd.
Right.
Did you or did you guys not mention George Floyd by name?
We did not mention him by name.
Okay.
What we did do was we had a prayer meeting We have a lot of African-American in our student ranks.
Right.
And we had a prayer meeting where we asked people to come in and just pray for what's going on in our country.
Yeah.
We issued a paper on critical race theory, criticizing aspects of critical race theory. I summarized it as critical race theory, bad racism equals real. You know, racism is a problem, but the way that they're going about it,
that's not the solution.
They're right in what they're critiquing, they're wrong in their solution.
I like it.
Right?
I like it. Okay.
But as we were doing that, what I realized is with a lot of home group leaders, a lot of us were looking at it and we're saying, okay, we got to be above the noise. So let's not engage our people on these issues.
Right.
Because it was just so much easier to just say, okay, let's just talk about the gospel. Let's not talk about this stuff. And where we've been pivoting is understanding we have to, when we're watching people go off the reservation, it's not on a central teaching level. It's not even necessarily on a home church level, but on a discipleship level.
Right.
We have to try to break through the fog and try to get people to think rationally and critically about these all this noise that's coming at them. And so I guess the question that I have is, when you're leading a group and you see people that you love, people that you respect, people that were never this way before, going off in these extremes, you know, it seems to me like what's lacking in so much of our culture right now is humility.
Yeah.
You know, you wrote about this, talking about the death of expertise and the way that experts are being rejected. How do we go at people in a loving, constructive way? I sense that we have to model humility and being able to reach them, but we need to just get people to kind of go down a DEFCON level.
That's a good way to put it.
And hear that we're not that different.
Yeah.
And I just wonder if you have thoughts about how to approach
it's
people.
It's a super question. So in political discourse, there's something called the Overton window. So the Overton window is the breadth of acceptable discussion in a country at a time. So there are things you could have said in the 50s that you really shouldn't have said in the 50s, but you could have said in the 50s, and it was like, okay, you can debate that. Well, the Overton window has shifted. You can't really say, are we for or against segregation? The Overton window has rightly shifted in our culture. That is outside of normal cultural discourse. So the Overton window is always shifting. So the question is, what's radical, what's offensive, and what's debatable? So let me take that term and apply it into the local church. Because part of the challenge is you're being now pressed to say, well, let's put a statement on critical race theory. What does that mean? What do we mean on that? You know, for me, I did a 10-part series, have significant objections to the prescriptions of critical race theory, and some even of the descriptions of critical race theory. So if that's the case, so where is the Overton window in your church? So can someone be a part of Dwell who believes that racism is bad, but that systemic racism is not really a thing anymore? I want to say focus on the gospel, walk in that journey together. I think if you think racism is sinful, that's essential. I think not thinking racism is sinful would be something in my church we discipline you for. I don't know if you do church discipline here, but we discipline you for. So racism is outside the Overton window, but what if I don't believe in systemic racism, but I really do care that individual examples of racism be addressed? And then the Overton window on the other side is that, you know, I believe systemic racism is really built into the culture of our society. Our society is so broken that it's built into it. But my solutions are not the solutions of the world. I think the solutions of the gospel, the scripture. Isaiah talks about how we treat one another. James talks about. So I believe in systemic racism, that it's pervasive. Let's say you're on the other side, that it's pervasive and it's real and it has to be addressed and it should be a major focus in the church. So the question to me is that an Overton window that's acceptable at Dwell? To me, that's a level of breadth that I could have had pre-2020. But it's a little harder now because people over here are saying, well, I'm not sure I want, if you're not with us on the struggle to address systems that are racially, you know, oppressive, then I don't want you in. I don't want you in this community. And then there are people over here say, well, if you think that racism is the heart and it's really the underbelly of everything, man, I don't think you love America. And so I don't think you need to be in this community. So the question is, what is the Overton window at a church? For me, the Overton window should be as broad as possible without compromising on issues of sin or issues of doctrine. And most of what I just described there are not issues of doctrine. They're issues of understanding of how culture plays itself out. So I think that's the question. So We're being pressed, though, and I would say, you know, probably you mentioned you had a significant African-American student population. My guess is that some of them press you to be more engaged and involved in some of those issues. You're nodding your head. Okay. So they're pressing you here. And other people are saying, we've done plenty. We've really worked hard at this, and we really care. And what I would say is having a conversation between those people may be essential for us to be able to walk together as brothers and sisters in Christ in a gospel community. So that would be not a perfect answer, but on those issues, having some place where we can disagree. I want people in my church who have different views. I still want people in my church who are Democrats and Republicans and Independents. I want people in my church who voted for Trump and Biden. I want people, and yet they feel very strongly about these things. And ultimately, it has to be what's our Overton window that's acceptable here. And I think things that are not sin and are not pronging in doctrinal issues should be part of the conversation, for what it's worth. Okay, so here. Yeah, go ahead. You go first, ma'am. Go ahead and just tell me your name.
My name's Christine.
Hi, Christine.
Just to piggyback on that point about Ryan's point about humility,
yeah.
I'm curious about, you've called yourself a missiologist.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. You have that up on the slide there. And my curiosity has to do with, if we are here as ambassadors for Christ, how far are we willing to go cross-culturally mm-hmm. to reach people, as opposed to preserving our churches or our society's norms that yeah. we're super used to.
Sure.
So like if I had a chance to serve in another country, in another field, I wouldn't go there expecting that culture to look like mine.
Right,
I would go there to understand and build bridges and ask questions mm-hmm. in order to find doorways for the gospel. And it just feels to me like in my own heart and maybe in our culture as believers, we have to challenge ourselves to move out of the dominant. We're not the dominant ideology. We have to think about ourselves as cross-cultural missionaries in fresh ways, I feel.
I would just amen that. I think that's right on. Yeah. I think the challenging question for us is that that used to be 20 years ago, maybe 30 years ago. When was Xenos started? 70s. Okay, cool.
Disco,
that's right. So in the 70s, there's probably some counterculture stuff. It was a new way of music, a new way of worship. That was missiologically contextualizing in the 70s. It's different today because kind of everyone, you know, most churches of larger size have sort of moved away, contextualization, et cetera, et cetera. So what I would say is, what does that look like, for example, to engage the LGBT community? What does it look like for me to hold biblically orthodox views and to move into the LGBT community. And if you're on the campuses around here, this is a huge part of the conversation. And what does it mean? And what I would say is have some grace for people who walk into that space and place and may decide, well, this is how I'm best going to engage this conversation. Recognize that people are trying to figure out how best to do it. You want to add some more, Christine? You can. Come on back. Come on back. I'm in charge of the microphone, Christine. Come on back. Go ahead. What were you going to add?
No. Well, I was just going to say it's not just campuses. It's like our jobs. Like,
totally.
I go to a job every day where my beliefs are so antithetical
right.
to everything most of my colleagues believe.
Exactly.
That it's sobering.
It is.
It's,
and they might see you as hostile because of your beliefs. Not just as different, but as hostile towards them.
The hostility is not as bad as the irrelevance.
Okay, fair enough.
Right? Like,
fair enough.
With yeah. hostility, you can engage, but yeah. with just, like, irrelevance. So yeah. I think we all have to think, it's not just on the campuses. If we're in any engagement in the secular world, with our neighbors, at work,
that's
anywhere,
fair.
We have to, we...
I threw it to the
I
campus.
Don't understand it. No, I
right.
know.
Because
I
it's
know.
So much more progressive.
Yeah.
Yeah. yeah.
But even... Yeah.
But even workplaces. I mean, and you have to, you'll be asked, you know, what is, you know, what's your gender identity? You know, these are all part of the things that are now part of the workplace. So good question, Christine. Let me go over here and then we'll come back. Yes, sir. Hey, tell me your name.
Jared.
Hi, Jared.
And I really appreciated your talk.
Thank
very,
you.
Very, very good.
You seem surprised, Jared. And I just want to, I'm not offended by that, but you're kind of like, you know, I really did appreciate that talk. All right.
No, I did. I really right. did. I know you've written about misinformation and kind of mm-hmm. conspiracy theory kind of yeah. things in the past. How do you personally go through to sort out what is a conspiracy theory, what is misinformation, yeah. that kind of thing?
You know, for me, I tend to ask the question, is it reported on in a mainstream news context? So, and I would include, you know, Fox News, the news division, you know, the CNN, others. So even CBN, for that matter, Christian Broadcasting Network, they tend not to report what would be conspiracy theories, but they tend to have different views. So I actually don't want to just look at what CNN reports, because I tend, you know, CNN tends to have a slant and Fox News tend to have a slant. But if I read CNN and Fox News, and they're both reporting on the same story, explaining it differently, I tend to think that probably has a level of credibility that's higher. Good. Thank you, Jared. Good question. Yes, sir. There you go. That's
and I appreciated your discussion of the Overton window, and you mentioned
I kind of applied it from politics into the church, but I hope it helped.
Yeah. And you're talking about how it slides.
Yeah.
I'm wondering if it narrows. And
it has in the church, for sure. That, I think that was part of my point, is that the narrowing of it, we want to... I would say, if you went back to the 50s, it was acceptable to have people who were for segregation and against segregation in a church, because we didn't see clearly as we should have seen. I don't think today you would say that that's an acceptable thing. I don't think it was acceptable then, but we see more clearly on issues of race today. So it did move, but I'd say part of the challenge today is... it is hard for you to keep somebody at Dwell who's a strong Trump supporter or someone who's a, you know, strong, aggressive, progressive on, because just it's harder for people on the sides in ways in the past. So Derwin Gray, who's a pastor in North Carolina, is a friend of mine. He says, we've got Trump hat wear, MAGA hat wearing Trump people sitting next to African-American social justice advocates. And it actually, when he says that, it actually offends both people. So he's saying it in a good way. His church celebrates church. He's an African-American. It's a multi-ethnic church. But even saying that, like, offends people. So the question is, what I would like in all those cases, though, is for us to listen and learn and understand one another. Mm-hmm. I think that's where we can broaden our understanding. Sin and outside of our doctrinal beliefs should be addressed. But I think we can learn. Listen, people came to different conclusions in the last election, and many of them did so on good, faithful grounds. Yeah. Into different conclusions. But keep going. You were going to say more.
Just the idea that these people that hold these ideas very strongly, sometimes you can get to the point where it's just like, I can't even identify with that mindset.
Yeah.
And I think the challenge that we need to give to ourselves is to allow ourselves to experience an uncomfortable openness to other ways of thinking so that we can approach people and just let them know, I consider you to be a valuable human being.
That's good. That's a good word. And I think politics teaches us not to do that, and I think we need to do better than politics. We need to be the body of Christ. I'll be right back. Come on, buddy. I'll go over here. I love this chair. This is, like, awesome. Tell me your name.
My name is Kevin.
Hi, Kevin.
Just a question on... as we're, like, thinking about engaging our culture, but at the same time keeping our unity strong, like, what are some of the biggest mistakes or, like, the best approaches that you've seen other churches take? Because that's just interesting to see. I think you have a specific vantage point across a broader swath of people than we would have said.
Yeah, so I would say a lot of the mistakes has to do with the feel that people feel they need to comment on everything. On the other side, they feel like comment on nothing. And I would say that when we saw after George Floyd and we saw the protests around the country, I think churches needed to respond in some way. And it sounds like you guys did. You had some conversations. You put this out. I mean, the whole world was talking about this. I mean, not just the United States. The whole world was talking about this. I think we should and always bring a biblical clarity that doesn't go along with the world, because remember, everything's accelerating. In some places, they're accelerating. I think it's good that people have more awareness of issues of race. You would actually put out a statement about it, right? That's a sign there's more awareness. But also, you put out a statement saying, you didn't use necessarily the term, you know, the cultural acceleration, but you said, but we're not this far. We're not going there. So I would say, don't feel the need to make your church into a place of cultural commentary, which is tricky, because I'm a cultural commentator. So I always tell pastors, don't do what I do. Because I write on stuff all the less so now, because I'm working towards a sabbatical soon. But I write on everything. So what I would say, don't do that. But at the same time, we have a moral voice in the world. And the Church of Jesus Christ needs to speak up on some issues, particularly when people might think that we don't care about them if we don't say something. So, for example, on January 6th, I think it's a bad thing. You know, it's a bad thing to people go in the Capitol riot. I think we all say it's a bad thing. What I would say is I felt an obligation differently when they prayed in Jesus' name on the floor of the House and the Senate. And so I wrote an article about that. Some churches made statements afterwards just to say, that's not who we are. We're the love your neighbor kind of Christian, not the storm the Capitol kind of Christian. You nervously laughed about that. You weren't sure. I saw that on a comedian put that on her bio. But what I would say is, when the world, by our silence, would assume that we don't care, I think it's appropriate to say something. But if we're consistently driven by speaking about cultural issues, we're not driven by the centrality of the gospel, the unity that comes in the body of Christ, the mission that we're on. We are not primarily, we're almost not, hardly ever, social. Our social commentary is lives lived and communities changed by the power of the gospel. There are sometimes it might raise to the level we might have to say something. And I think you did around race, maybe some did around January 6th, but it's tricky. I wouldn't do it a lot. That's the mistakes I think people make. Because when you do it a lot, you're basically just seen as, and you can never give enough nuance to something, right? Because it's like, well, what about this? Why didn't you mention this? Why didn't you mention that? So that becomes a challenge. Great question.
I'm back, and I cleared everyone out behind me.
There were two, there was a woman there, and you don't look at all like
just
her.
Just all gone.
Okay, wow.
I think you've been awesome. Okay. You drove 6 hours here today, and you've got an early morning tomorrow, so.
With you, let's be clear.
Yeah.
It's not for preaching. You want to go to breakfast at 7:30 a.m. So let's just be clear why I have an early morning tomorrow.
You've got a very difficult person to meet with in the morning.
Exactly. Amen. Amen.
Thank you so much.
Thank you, everybody.
Thank you. Appreciate it so much.
Thanks for listening. This has been a Dwell Community Church production.